Jason Bader is back on episode 12 of the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast, ladies and gentlemen. Jason has a lot of experience with helping distributors with their inventory, but he's become more of a holistic business advisor. He's the president of the distribution team. Visit distributionteam.com. That's distributionteam.com. This is the official podcast of the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors. And coming up in February, I can't believe it's here already, is Nailed Innovation, their yearly conference. This year, it's being held at the Westin Mission Hills in Rancho Mirage, California, February 13th to 16th. Be there or be square. This podcast is sponsored by one of my favorite nailed vendors. They're going to be at this show for sure, Keystone Technologies. Keystone is a manufacturer of lighting equipment that sells through distribution. So if you're a distributor and you want to bring on a line of quality LED products, go to KeystoneTech.com. That's KeystoneTech.com. Remember, they have their line voltage T5HO and T5HE LED tube replacements. Why go line voltage with T5? Well, I've talked about it before. T5 already has the unshunted sockets you need. You simply disconnect that ballast, slam the line voltage right into the unshunted sockets, and Bob's your uncle. Fixture's running. You don't have to worry about ballast compatibility issues. You don't have to worry about ballast failures, and those T5 ballasts cost a lot. So go to KeystoneTech.com to register as a distributor, or email T5@KeystoneTech.com. If you want to buy some Keystone products, they'll also point you in the right direction to who can help you. So without further ado, I give you Jason Bader. He's back again on episode 12, talking lighting, talking LEDs, talking DLC of the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast.
I think we'll just jump right into it. I mean, Greg and I got to say, are curious about why you think inventory is so important. It's kind of an afterthought for us. And I remember your first... You reminded me 8 years ago or whatever when I first met you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, talk to us about the importance of inventory in our business and understanding it.
Well, first and foremost, for any distributor, it is your largest asset. That's all your money. I mean, if you look at the finances of a distribution company, at least 75% is, yeah, that's cash. I mean, that's inventory. Mm. That is your cash. That's all your money. And so... Yes, it becomes an afterthought because it's not in the prettiest place anymore. You know, you kind of put it somewhere and maybe you have the lowest paid employees that manage it. So it does become that afterthought. But again, if you really think about it, that is your business. That is your company. Now, obviously, you know, sales is a big, big piece of that and the promotion of your companies. But without anything to sell... And without anything in good condition to sell, you're out of luck. I mean, you're not going to make any money. And so that's why I think it's one of the, that's the most important piece of that. And then if I look at, most distributors do not fail because they run out of sales. I mean, they can sell. That's what you all are really, really good at. What happens to most distributors is they mess up the money side. And that's the big part, of course, is that inventory. So that's really where distributors fail is, you know, maybe some salesperson decides doesn't like their boss anymore and they're going to go start a distribution company. Sure. Barrier to entry is pretty low. I mean, you know, let's face it, $50,000 and a mini storage, and you're probably in business. You know, you can probably go and flip some inventory out there. But where it gets complicated is salespeople tend to like to keep buying and buy, oh, I bet I could sell that. I bet I could sell that. And there's this optimism that occurs. Well, optimism is expensive. And so they keep buying and buying. All of a sudden they get loaded with a bunch of stuff that all of a sudden nobody wants. And now they have to discount to get rid of it or do these different things. But yeah. They still have all this cash going out. And then, of course, then somebody decides not to pay them on time, string them out a little bit. Next thing you know, you're out.
Yeah.
You've overextended
so
yourself.
So what happens is it becomes a cash flow issue.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I totally see that with distributors. You know, we have a couple friends in the business, and you think about the size of inventories, and then you're let's say you're recording a profit every quarter, Greg, mm-hmm. and you have a huge inventory. and let's say, you know, hey, maybe 30% of that inventory needs to be discounted, or it's garbage, or it's just not sellable stuff anymore,
right.
Or you bought it for, you know, $35 and it's worth $6.
So, yeah. So, Jason, you don't know a lot of my background, but we're a lighting distributor again out of Minneapolis, and I don't spend a lot of time at all on inventory. And I, you know, kind of am on the page of the less the better in a way.
Yeah, I'm with him.
But as a distributor, you need to have product. Sure. So is there a fine line, or what are, if you could point out three things for a guy like me who doesn't focus a lot of time on inventory, it can be five, I don't know, whatever it might be, but a number of things that someone like me should look at and consider when they're talking inventory.
Well, when you're thinking about it, I mean, obviously you're right. I agree with you. Less is better. And, you know, a lot of folks have a ton of inventory on hand. I mean, they've got a lot of inventory, so they think that they've got this figured out. You know, maybe you got a couple $1 million worth of inventory there. Well, you can have that much inventory, but it's just not the right stuff. And so I think one of the bigger issues that you've got to look at is understanding what your customers actually want you to have on the shelf. That is far more important than the quantity that you have on the shelf, is what you have on the shelf. As I said, I mean, I have a lot of clients that have got a boatload of inventory sitting there, and they think they're supposed to be able to meet all the needs of the customers. You know, oh, no, I got everything. Well, you didn't ask the customer what they really wanted. And to really understand that, you've got to look at more historical data. So you've got to be a good, you've got to have a decent software package, and most of you all do. I mean, let's face it. But what you're really looking for is some trend analysis. What do people want you to have on the shelf? You know, and so I look at transactional, and I call them hits, but transactions against inventory. So the things with the high transactions, well, invest in more of those. And then things that are waning in popularity, they have fewer transactions against it, get out from under those. Occasionally, you're going to miss a sale. If you get out from under that stuff, yep. But that's okay. It's really not that bad. It's very few. See, what I've come to find is at least 60% of your inventory will not be sold every 30 days.
Is that a number you look for, 30 days as a rule of thumb?
Not necessarily 30 days, but it's going to give me a quick indication of how much money I want to invest in it. So, I mean, and that's really, it's just one of those eye-opening moments, and you're like, ooh, this isn't good. You know, yeah, I'd say that, you know, most of your sales, I mean, the Pareto principle may or may not work, you know, that 20% of your inventory.
Explain that principle again.
Oh, yeah, 20%. I'm sorry.
Oh, this is the Pareto principle?
Yeah, Pareto principle is 20%. It's the 80-20 rule. That's kind of that Pareto principle. But the 20% of your inventory will account for 80% of your sales dollars. And you can do it in pretty much, Pareto tends to work in a whole lot of different things. But what I find is understanding the customer preferences when you're making inventory investments, that's really the smart move. Again, most distributors carry at least 35 to 40% more inventory than they will ever need to make their customers really, really happy. But they tend not to analyze, and they just go from gut feel. So that's one of the big problems.
We do a little bit of gut feel.
Yeah.
Well, of course. Definitely. I mean, that's, you know, that's just fun. I mean, that's just what makes distribution fun. And it's okay. And it's okay to swing and miss. It really is.
That's an interesting way to put it, eh?
Yeah. Distributors are terrible. I mean, let's face it. They are terrible at pinpointing what a customer is really going to want. I mean, let's say you introduce 10 new products.
Yep.
How many of those are actually going to be turning in inventory?
Yeah, I know.
It's miserable. I mean, most distributors say it's two or three. You know, whenever I do a speaking engagement, I'll ask that question. Yeah, two or three at best. That's a bad average right there. I mean, that is a bad picker. So, you know, it's okay to try this stuff, but you need to have the cash to do it. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, if you're throwing money at inventory and you don't pay attention to it, you don't have the cash to go try some stuff out.
Now, I don't know what other industries you deal with. I know you do with lighting, but how much of the other industries, and it's kind of a couple part question here, but how much does brand actually matter anymore? Has it changed since you started? And I know that varies by industry, probably.
So sure. You're talking about somebody represents is a Philips distributor or GE.
Correct. In terms of lighting, but right. And then I also want you to relate it to the other industries. If there is brand preference or people don't really care of the brand, they just want the item that works.
It tends to be industry by industry. So, for example, let's say in the fastener industry. fastener industry can be fairly generic. A lot of it's imported, so brand is less preferential, except you know maybe if you have government contracts, things like that, that require certain domestic purchasing. But no, brand is not as specific. And then it gets to, I deal a lot in the pool equipment supply business, pool and chemical, and that is very brand specific, you know, because certain, the installers of that product like a particular type of pump and heater and all that has to work together. So brand is very, you know, that's very important. As far as lighting is concerned, just my personal look at it, I don't see it. I mean, I don't see brand as being all that important, especially if you have quality competitors out there.
Right.
I mean, 'cause let's face it, when we look at, you know, what a light does, I mean, are we really looking for a specific brand, or do we just want it to look good? You know, want to make us feel good? That's really it.
Yeah, you want to get the bulb you need. You want to put it in, and you want to move on with your life.
That's it. Yeah,
I don't think you're thinking I have GE bulbs or I have Philips bulbs or my lamps.
But it
are
used
from
to
this.
Be that way.
It used to be that way.
And it's interesting that it's not anymore. And I wonder if
something changed.
Part of the reason we're here, this DLC conference, if it's because they tell you what your requirements are. You meet them, you're qualified, then everything's...
DLC is the brand.
Yeah.
DLC is the brand. Remember we were talking about the industry associations on the last podcast?
Yeah.
I think DLC is really... That's what they've done, is they've stolen everybody's brand message. And they've encapsulated their brand saying, you can't be good unless you're DLC.
Right.
And that's what they've done.
Tell me about DLC. Is it...
The conference is in Portland this week.
Okay.
That's what we're going to. We have a podcast with the executive director.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I mean, now is it an accreditation?
So DLC is Design Light Consortium.
And okay.
It started in this area.
It's like Energy Star.
Yeah.
Okay, like Energy Star. Okay.
They get together and they say the characteristics of a product needs to meet these minimums.
Sure.
And then once you get it, you get qualified. And then distributors like us pretty much only can buy DLC.
DLC's captured the branding of the...
Yeah, it's an accreditation play.
Yeah.
That's what it is. I mean, look, this is... I mean, I hate to say it. That is one of the biggest rackets I've ever seen in my life is accreditation. I mean, seriously. Okay, so for example, let's say that you could not get hired as a purchasing person unless you were distribution team certified.
Right, right.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, you know,
that
for you, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't tell any, I mean, it really doesn't make that person any better or worse. I'm going to tell you right now. Yeah, they went through some training and things like that, but they could have got that training from anybody I know, you know, tons of people I know out there.
Sure.
It's a racket. I don't... buy a lot of this unless there's tremendous testing available. I mean, you know,
they do. They don't do any testing. Everyone else does the testing. They just submit it to them.
Yeah. So
that's how it works. No, they do that. You do independent testing. You get it done in a lab, and then you submit it to the DLC.
Submit it, and then they approve it. Yeah, basically.
Yeah. So Jason Bader, for the record, thinks it's a racket.
Yeah, yeah. I'm telling you right now. I'm telling you. You know, and hey, I would love to be in that racket. I'm telling you right now.
More power to him.
I got nothing against somebody making money. I'm good with that. But I think we have to understand what it is.
Yeah,
you know,
sure. And whether it's actual value in the chain or not.
Totally agreed. Yeah, totally agreed.
I think we're going to ask Tina Halfpenny this question.
If DLC is a brand.
Yeah, is it just a brand in the marketplace? Because we're interviewing the executive director of the... I'm just going
to
ask her.
I'd love to hear the response. You know, absolutely. Because I look at this and...
I'm going to
don't be at anything. You know, and it's okay to be honest about it.
Yeah, sure. Let's talk about it.
I'm good. You know, I'm good with them making money like this. Hey, wish I thought of it. Wish I had pulled that string, you know, but it didn't happen. And that's good. I'm nothing against that.
So. No, going back to some of the other industries and things you work in.
Sure.
Just to try to relate it to lighting some and what people have talked about in the future that could potentially happen is... Are any of the industries you work with the manufacturers, the distributor as well?
There is a little bit of jumping the chain, sure. Sure. There's a little bit of folks that will go direct. And so, floor covering is one example. So you've got floor covering, traditional supply chain was the mill, then the wholesaler, then the dealer, and then the end user, you know, the installer for that matter.
Installer, or
it could have been the homeowner or something like that. Well, the wholesalers kind of get knocked out of that deal, and frankly, it was due to their own laziness, to be honest with you. I mean, if I could tell a brief story, what happened is I wind up doing research in the floor covering industry. I Don't know why I got dragged into that business. I knew nothing about it. So I wound up doing a little research and finding out about how that supply chain works, where the wholesalers could add value, those types of questions in there. And finally, one of the mill guys says, hey, let me tell you what really happened here. I said, all right. The years and years ago, this is probably late 80s, the floor covering wholesalers had a sales force that they would call on the dealers, right? They had an outside sales team, and so did the mill. The mill had an outside sales team that they would present to the dealers as well, and they would do joint sales calls. And the wholesalers all looked at each other and said, well, it's kind of a duplication of effort. Why don't we just let these mills call on the dealers on our behalf, and we'll just be the fulfillment arm. You know, we'll just take care of and we'll service the account, we'll expedite orders, things like that for them. Well, all of a sudden, now the relationship is between mill and dealer.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden, the wholesalers just aced themselves out of that deal. And now today, I'd say that probably 90% of carpeting goes direct from the mill to the dealer. Barely passes through.
That's interesting because I do a lot of drop shipping with my suppliers.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I look at it and I go, I gotta make sure that I don't get too into this, because you know, there comes a point when you're sending them so, like, their minimum order is $100, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're sending them so many $100 orders.
Mm-hmm.
And then you talk to them, hey, why don't I just give you $5 and you can do all my orders for me? You know, per order, I'll just pay you so I don't have to pick orders. Because I mean, picking orders is a pain in the butt, right? And then combining them and stuff like that.
Sure.
And like, you know, what if I just don't do it ever, right?
Sure.
But then you kind of lose your business in a way, you know?
You do.
You kind of give it to them in a way.
You
and
do.
Then why would they get it? Why would they do it with you if they're already picking $100 orders, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, it's one of those things where I do it a lot, but I keep a little bit of stock, but I try to keep it to a minimum. Is that? I don't know. Are you with me on this one, Gregor?
I am. Yeah, and
you want to be careful. Like, these wholesalers gave their business away.
They did. They absolutely gave
that
away.
I kind of see that in lighting. So.
Yeah,
I see that.
Oh, let me make joint sales calls with you.
Yes.
No. No joint sales calls.
You know, actually, joint sales calls are okay. It came down to this. And this is not my words. This was a gentleman, you know, a mill, a large carpet mill, that he said, hey, look, he who controls the relationships in the market space controls the market.
And customer, yes.
Controls the market. And I was like, okay, that is a profound statement. And so generally what I'll tell people is it's joint sales calls. Now, those are good as long as there's a good purpose for that representative to be with you. Now, I think there's a lot of great, you know, reasons to have a joint sales call. One is some customers really dig on the fact that you are bringing the factory guy with you. Mm. Makes them feel special.
Sure.
I'm okay with that. That's good. Maybe it's something that you're not technically an expert in and you would like that little side saddle help. No problem at all. I think that's a good purpose. You know, maybe, I don't know, introducing product. Maybe you want to train one of your salespeople. You know, manufacturers' reps in some cases can actually be tremendous training arms for you. So, you know, there are purposes for it, but I think, yeah, absolutely.
I'm gonna
I would
cut
agree.
You off. You know why? The reason why I don't like it, I'm not to be rude to cut you off, the reason why I don't like it is because you have, let's say you have an NDA with a manufacturer or whatever, like a
sure.
non-disclosure agreement or in this and that. You don't, like, you can't enforce those on employees. Right. So as soon as that your employee and that employee go out
mm-hmm.
to another place, you're exposing that relationship to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And in where I'm at, there's a lot of incestuous business going on in the lighting game. So people are moving from, say, major, you know, tier one distributor manufacturer over to major tier one wholesaler over to major tier two wholesaler. You know what I mean? They're moving around over 10 years. And if you start investing time and energy into a non-employee to have relationships with your customers, I think you're exposing yourself.
Very, very common, you know, very common fear, very common, you know, hesitance. And this is actually why there's not as much joint sales calls, you know, activity going on, is because there's been too much jumping of the chain. There's been too much of this, as you said, incestuous behavior, but then a lack of integrity associated with that. I think that's the bigger issue.
Do you think it's wrong? See, that's a good question. You know, so you have an employee that has an NDA with you, Now in Ontario, those NDAs mean absolutely nothing when they and it's really a handshake agreement between honorable people.
Interesting.
You can't enforce them in a court of law. The court of law will say, this is this man's trade. His trade is to sell light bulbs, and because he was working for you doesn't mean he can't sell light bulbs for other people. That's like telling an electrician they can't join wires together anymore for any other
company.
True.
Right? I agree with that.
So there's like a moral principle that says people have to be able to apply their trades. So you can't, even if you have an NDA with a customer or with a supplier or whatever, that NDA can't be enforced. So legally.
Now, wait. Now, okay, I understand that they can go sell light bulbs because that is their profession. Sure. No problem. But that customer list that I put in place and that I've provided here, that's company property. I think that should be where your argument again on an NDA is all about, is you cannot take my customer list, you cannot take my inventory levels, you cannot take my pricing. Mm. That's company information. And I think that should be enforceable. It's interesting because California, I was exposed to this. California tends to be more of an NDA state versus non-compete agreements with your employees just do not work.
Yeah,
and they're failing left and right across.
You can't enforce them.
Yeah, all around North America, they fall apart. Yeah. Where an NDA has a better chance because you're talking about competitive information. I think that's a better shot.
I think California is probably on the front lines of that because of all the Silicon Valley stuff going on and how important
very
it is
possible
to those companies' yeah. information is. It actually is what they do is information. But whew, we're off topic from inventory.
Yeah, we sure. shot. I'm sorry, we shot a little bit.
Get back to right.
So going back to inventory
yes.
a little.
Yeah.
What are some like common turns or what are we? What were we?
What is an inventory turn?
Give us
okay, sure. You know, inventory turn is basically how many times can you buy it and sell it, buy it and sell it, buy it and sell it. I mean, that's the basic definition.
Within a certain period of time?
Yeah, I mean, you know, to count as a turn, it's a 12-month period of time. I mean, the actual math formula is 12 months cost of goods sold from stock sales divided by average inventory value.
I told you we'd have a definition.
There's the math. That's the math program. Yeah. You teach it enough times.
No, I said to him elevator on the way down. Yeah, this is the question I'm going to ask. And Jason's going to have a technical answer.
I got a tech answer.
Now for us to remember.
Now the easy way is in a period of 12 months, how many times? Yes, sell it and buy it, sell it and buy it, sell it and buy it. And that's really what you're trying to do. And basically, you really don't want to hang on to inventory very long. I mean, that's the whole point of it because it does start costing you money the longer it sits on your shelf. I think, frankly, one of the biggest costs is an opportunity cost. What could I have done with that dollar that I, you know, if I had invested in something else that turned faster, had a higher margin on or something like that?
Okay.
You know? Because, I mean, we don't have infinite amount of money. We can't go to this magic ATM, you know, machine and pull out cash left and right. So inventory turns is an important thing. I think sometimes distributors, you know, weigh everything on inventory turns. I mean, I think that is the omnipotent measurement, you know, for inventory. And it's a nice one. It's good. But what they do is they try to spin inventory way too fast. Now, if I'm a purchasing person or an inventory management person and my compensation was based on inventory turns,
so you've seen this. You've seen
managers compensated. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Okay.
And now if I wanted to spend inventory really quick, it's pretty darn simple. I just quit buying stuff.
Okay.
Inventory value is going to plummet.
Sure.
And it's going to, you know, it's going to spin. But now I'm going to get killed on the customer service side because I don't have anything to sell. So that's the balancing act. There has to be another measurement associated with that, and that's that customer service percentage. Customer service percentage just really means, did the inventory I put on my shelf match what the customer was asking for?
Customer service percentage, that's
yeah.
called.
Customer service percentage.
What's the math on that?
The math on that one is, number of line items shipped complete versus number of line items sold.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, so basically back orders get dinged on this. You know, if you can't ship complete, then that's considered a customer service failure.
You get zero.
You get a zero on that one. That's correct.
It's either 100 or zero.
Either 100 or zero.
So you get a 10-line order. If 9 of them are in stock and the 10th one isn't, it's still a zero.
No, it's a 90.
Oh, it's a 90. Yeah, okay.
By an order, you can have a deviation on that. But line by line, pass, fail.
Okay.
Got it.
Yeah. So now you balance those two things. You know. So again, if I'm trying to, you know, have a really, really high customer service percentage, well, okay, that means I'm going to have a lot of inventory to fill that. Okay, so that's going to kill turns. So this is the balancing act of any inventory manager is customer service percentage versus inventory turns. If I try to spin turns really, really quick, I'm not going to have any inventory on hand. More back orders, customer service percentage drops down.
So what do you see as the ideal percentage of both?
Ideal percentage, what I'm shooting for is about 90, low 90s
for customer service.
And then turns, I like to see somewhere around six.
Six in a year.
If I can get six in a year, I am shooting, you know, I'm doing well. Anything more than that, I have to ask the question, am I putting myself at risk for too many back orders? Too many back orders means customers get really annoyed with you and they stop calling.
Yeah, I think you have to be careful with playing with people's deliveries in a way.
Yeah,
they don't want to get three different couriers for one order.
No. Right.
You know, because it's coming from different places and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just something about getting here's your package from Premier Lighting.
Right.
Or these are your three boxes.
Yep.
And that matters, I think.
I would agree.
Yep. You know, and that's what keeps the distributor, I think, in business is that. You know, people don't want to do all the research on everything. And, you know, it's tough.
They call you because they want it. They want it now and they want to move on.
Yeah, move on with their
lives. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, so, exactly.
So as far as inventory turns, if it's less than six and you say get it off your shelf?
No. There's going to be a lot of items that are going to be less than six turns. So it's always a balance. What you're looking at is the whole mix, the full mix. You're going to have some speedy ones and you're going to have some slow ones.
What about value? Like, how would you look at a piece of inventory that, say, you see a bankruptcy, say? Right?
Yeah.
And, you know, so, you know, like I can get all that guy's inventory for X amount of dollars.
Yep.
And I know that 50% of it is going to take 10 years to sell, maybe 20, maybe never. Mm-hmm. The other 50%, but I'll keep it. You know what I mean? How would you look at items like that you got at a really low cost? We talked about that in the last podcast.
Yeah.
Kind of sitting on stuff.
Again, I think in your industry, sitting on stuff's just bad. I mean, that's just trouble. You know, that stuff's going to... I would just take the 50% that I didn't pay for and just dump it and just be done with it.
Is that right?
Because, think about, your space. Now, think about your space in your places. I mean, really, do your warehouse managers, do they complain that they have too much space?
No.
No, never, ever.
They use it all the time.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, they're going to load it to the gunwale. So why waste your space on stuff that's just not going to sell? I mean, come on, distributors are optimists. They really are. So they're like, you know, if that knucklehead couldn't sell it, I can probably sell it. No, you can't. Yeah. Let's face it. So just don't do that. You know, that's a...
Yeah. So back to the math. Yeah. I like these math equations.
I like the math. All right.
Helps me relate it. So
all right.
Is there a percentage of your revenue that should be inventory? Your sales revenue should equal X amount.
So it goes to... that goes from cost of goods sold. So you take your revenue, get down to cost of goods sold.
Okay.
So cost of goods sold, and remember from stock sales. So please peel out all those direct ships, all that kind of stuff. Get down to your cost of goods sold number, and then divide that by your inventory value, average inventory value. So does it become a function of revenue? Absolutely.
So do a real life example for us, and where you should be if you're at $1 million.
Okay, got $1 million in revenue. Yep. Okay, so and give me your average margin, just
40%.
Okay, so that'd be $600,000 in cost of goods sold.
Yeah.
All right, so you got $600,000 cost of goods sold, and you want, if you got $600,000, $150,000 would be, be four turns. So $150,000 in inventory value. Would be four turns. That'd be a clean four turns. You know, and four turns tends to be, now six turns is more of an ideal. Four turns tends to be what I see everywhere, in most industries out there. That's really kind of the math backwards on that thing. And so you're trying to get yourself a little closer to six if possible, but most people would be thrilled if they had pure four turns. I mean, thrilled. So
see, I think the bigger your business is, the more this matters.
Yeah.
I think the guy with the storage
shed.
You know, is not thinking inventory turns.
No.
Right? But it starts to get when you're looking at
they're thinking
inventory,
about cash flow.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When he's thinking about sell. I'm still kind of thinking sell. I can sell my way out of any problem. Right. you know what I mean? I kind of have that mindset. And but it's like the bigger that inventory number gets, the more you got to start thinking about it with these conceptual ideas, with these mathematics, the less of a handle you have on it because it's more stuff. I mean, you probably know most of the items you have in your warehouse, I bet.
Yeah, I do.
Like, you know what's there and you think of it sometimes when you're driving around and selling somebody something, I
bet. Yeah, for sure.
Like, oh, I have that case of warm white tubes back there. Yeah. Right? You know you have it, right? But when it gets to a point where you have no idea what you have,
yeah,
like you're not connected to the products at all, you really have to start looking at the math.
When you start getting up, you know, $20 million in revenue and greater, that's when this inventory burden is going to be there. And, you know, frankly, that's when it's left to software. That's when you start utilizing software and allowing that to tell you what you should and shouldn't have there. But you do need to understand every month that you're looking at, okay, what has fallen out of favor? Because items fall out of favor quickly. And especially in your business, I think that there would be SKUs that do fall out of business relatively
quickly.
Crazy
right now.
It's happening like crazy. Because you've got, you know, because you have superseded, you know, something supersedes it. And all of a sudden, you know, what was awesome 2 or 3 months ago, maybe, you know, 6 months ago, it's, you better get out from under it quick because you don't want to be the last person at the train station, you know, waiting for something to come by. So
something just popped in my head, Jason. So just to tell the listeners out there that we are the official podcast of the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Visit NAILD.org. That's NAILD.org. And join the association, take some educational courses, and listen to the podcast, Get a Grip on Lighting. So, Jason, do you want to change gears a little bit? I got something else I want to ask.
Yeah, go for it. Please do.
So, you know, you had talked about being a holistic business advisor. I think that's so Portland, isn't it?
It's such a very Portland thing. Yeah,
holistic. Okay.
Yeah, I was trying to put it on a business card. It didn't work.
Not on the East Coast, I don't think.
Not at all.
So you go out, you're helping out business managers, you're helping out owners, executives, this kind of thing. What's the biggest problem that you see that most people have in common? What is it? When you're out there, is there one thing that distribution companies seem to have in common and that you
right
can
now
solve? Yeah.
Oh, right now it's recruiting. I mean, recruiting is just brutal. But you know, I think that I can solve. Debatable about that one. I think that's a whole different discussion. And briefly, I think distributors have been in the mindset of hiring people and not recruiting people. You know, they're too focused on just filling the slot. So all of a sudden the slot opens up, like, uh-oh, I got to fill this. And so they're rushing, you know, basically rushing out and saying, okay, where's the next heartbeat? You know, somebody who'll you know, work for minimum wage, come on in. Can you drive a truck? Yes, no, debatable. Can you pass the drug test? Yes, no, debatable.
You have a forklift license? Yes, no, you know what I mean?
I'll get that for you. I can take care of that for you. I got that in the back pocket. So it's always a reactionary. It's always reactionary to when you have a need, you know, instead of thinking a little bit forward and say, you know what, I'm going to start hunting for the very best people possible. And they probably already have a job right now. So that's the thing I think that's the most difficult right now for most people. I mean, everybody's competing. They're just fighting for the right person to bring in. And really the only way that these folks are going to grow. I mean, one client of mine was saying, you know, they wanted to grow a sales team. I'm like, great. You got to start with raw materials. So let's get the best raw materials in the company, in the company first. We will grow them into salespeople, but you got nothing right now.
Yeah.
And why are we going to go and get somebody else's rejects? You know,
there's a lot of floaters out there in Toronto, you know, that come in for job interviews and they're floaters, man. You know?
And they're going to be out of there in a little while, you know. So
I've had a lot of problems. I mean, I of all the people I know, my biggest issue is human resources. Yeah. I have a really hard time hiring people. I have a really hard time, I find that we'll train them. We'll bring someone in.
Mm-hmm.
We'll train them. Mm-hmm. And they'll spend a year, 2, 3 years with us. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's a millennial issue. I think we talked a little bit about millennials.
Sure.
Next thing you know, oh, I want to move back to the Netherlands. Or, oh, I'm chasing the dream of getting sponsored by Monster. I'm going to flip my bike. You know, or, you know, I'm going to do bike flipping. I want to work, you know, from home. And this guy offered me, And there's just, it goes on and on. Mm-hmm. There's all the, you know, I find that, you know, you seem to be able to hang on to people out in Minneapolis.
We've had pretty good luck, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you don't have a lot of people turns.
The key word was luck. I don't know if you heard that.
Yeah, yeah.
He doesn't have as many people turns.
Right, right. Yeah, definitely less turn on that. Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to is again that whole raw materials. You know, the right getting the right people in the job. But the big question I try to ask people is, you know, they spend a lot of time being salespeople. They understand value proposition. You know, what is your value proposition to your customer? And people have got that down pretty well now. They can go out and sell products, so they've been thinking about this a lot. So I try to tell them, okay, why don't we just turn that just a little bit askew and say, all right, what is your value proposition to a new candidate coming into your company? Do you know? You know, what are you selling that these people, you know, on the other side of the desk are going to be buying? And I think that's often baffling for a lot of business owners.
You know, I thought that way for a bit, and I think it's For me, I have to think about it, what they can give to me.
Like, I hate to say it that way.
That's what the mentality that gets you in trouble.
I don't know, because I think once I define what they have to give me, then I can give it something to them.
Does that make sense? Like, I don't know. I find like if I try to think about creating the perfect job for them, I always end up losing on the losing end of that.
Oh, it's not the perfect job for them. No, I'm saying that the job's defined. You sure know what you need. But what I'm saying is, in order to either unseat someone from a current job, you know, because again, the best candidates, generally speaking, are employed already.
Yeah, I hate hiring people from other companies.
I do too. But I mean, look, let's face it, that the most talented people are probably being recruited by others. You know, they're not just sitting there waiting for your phone call.
Sure.
And so if you want to go to the front of the line there, you're going to have to sell something. So why does somebody want to come work for your company? That's the question that you have to ask yourself. I mean, and really, you don't ask yourself anymore because you've been in it too long.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, your blinders, I mean, you've got an answer, but
that's because Greg is super cool. That's why they'd want to work for
that's
him.
That's exactly it. Yeah. That's right. Because I'm awesome. You know, and so we say things like, oh, we got great benefits, we got this, we got that, we got vacation, blah, 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 blah. Are we sure that matters to the candidate? Don't know.
You know what? It's a funny.
Different candidate. Yeah, it's a different candidate.
Some people like vacation. How do you find that out?
You ask your employees. You ask. Just straight ask. You basically, and this is going to sound really goofy. In an interview,
you're going to say what matters to you? In the interview.
Not in the interview. No. To your current employee base. Yeah, especially the people that have recently come on. Like, well, why'd you come to work here? Or very simply, just, you know, to people who have been there for a while, say, well, why do you work here? You know, and you're going to get some very funny answers. You know, some of them, I want a paycheck. Fair enough. I get that one. Beyond that, though, I think you're going to get some really interesting answers that maybe didn't occur to you. What is valuable to them? And then that starts to frame your value proposition to this next person. I mean, if we really want to, in the millennial world, if you want to attract millennials, you need to ask a millennial what's interesting about your company. Why do they work for you? And then you start to frame your sales job around that. So it's not us anymore. We can't come up with the right answer anymore. I mean, I hate to say it. We have to rely on the people that work for us today to say why they would work for our companies.
Why is that? Because do you think it's because we don't see it, what, like, I've never worked for anybody in my adult life. Like, I've never had a boss in my adult life other than my dad. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and
that's,
you know,
a whole different set of problems.
Yeah.
Right,
but
there.
You know, the funny thing is, it's like, I don't know. It's, you know, it's, I've always been responsible to make the money or whatever on my own, or come up with the plan to make money. And I just don't get it when people don't think that way.
Exactly. And that's why we have to ask others for the answer. I mean,
that comes around, right?
Yeah. I mean, and that's why we have to ask others, because we don't get it. I mean, look, I grew up in an entrepreneurial family. You know, I worked for my dad for most of my, you know, early career. I've really never, I mean, I did have other, you know, minor jobs, but I'm not the right guy to ask. You know, and so if you think about in your companies, maybe you're not the right guy to ask either. Mm-hmm. So you start interviewing the people inside your company. Hey, why should someone work here? Or why do you work here?
And I actually asked that. I got a funny answer from one of my people. They said because we don't have any social things that we do. I said, what do you mean? He goes, I don't want to go to a company where I have to go out once a week with my coworkers. You know, he's like, I like that. It's just Monday to Friday. I work my job. I don't hang out with the people from my job. I have my friends that I hang out with, and I come here. I earn my money and I go home. He didn't put it, wasn't that long-winded, but that's what he was getting after. Mm-hmm.
He liked
I get that. I really get that. I'm okay with that.
He didn't want to go axe throwing on the Tuesday with everybody from the office. He just wanted to go home to his house.
Right.
And hang out with his, you know, his girlfriend or whatever.
Axe throwing? Sorry,
I don't really get that. No, my buddy of mine runs a company, and they, every week they have some social event that everybody goes to, and it's like one of them was axe throwing.
Okay.
And he's like, well, I'm like, what are you doing tonight? He's like, we're going axe throwing with the team. And it's like, you just go drink beer and you throw axes? You never done this?
I've never done this.
Come on. There's like huge in Toronto. There's axe throwing places open. I thought for sure they'd throw axes in Portland. Come on.
That would be interesting.
Google Portland axe throwing on your phone right now. Come on. We should go tonight.
Oh my God.
Go axe throwing.
God. My God. Yeah, nobody's going to axe throw. Now there is bicycle jousting.
What the heck is bicycle jousting?
Oh, bicycle jousting is cool.
What is it?
So if you ever want to Google something fun, Portland bicycle jousting. So let's say you take a have you ever seen a double-decker bicycle?
Okay,
you know, people weld another frame on top of it, and so they're really high up in the air.
Okay, yeah.
Well, okay, so
I'm sure
you
those
have a
are popular in Portland.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of that weird stuff. I mean, trust me, this is a goofy place. So then you have this long pole with a boxing glove on the front of it, and you ride at each other as fast as you can, and you joust.
And it's legit.
Oh, yeah. And you knock each other off of this. Oh,
I would
Google.
See this.
Oh, it is hysterical. I would pay to see this live. It is hysterical.
That's funny.
Funniest. Yeah.
Bicycle jousting.
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome.
I haven't heard of that.
Naked bike ride. We got all kinds of
stuff. You got it all going
here.
Out. Portland's an interesting place.
It's an interesting place.
What's with the Keep Portland Weird meme? What's that about?
Apparently, people do not. They think that for some reason, we're going to have this collective. Conservative, wave that'll drop into here, and it's never going to happen. Portland's just a goofy place. Half of it, or part of it, is still in the '60s. You have a lot of those people that stayed, and people just like the eclectic nature of Portland. I mean, there's a really diverse mix here, really diverse. And what's crazy is you have so much new population coming in. Portland is definitely changing. So I think people are really afraid that it's going to lose that kind of eclectic, weird vibe, you know, with so much influx of
Are you talking about immigrants to the United States?
No.
You're talking about people
from other states? Other states.
Oh, interesting. Okay. And
literally,
so,
we will walk. I could walk down the block here, and I would say probably 25 to 30% of the plates are going to be out of state.
Now, are you Portland born and raised?
Born and raised, fifth generation.
Okay.
Yeah,
you're an old soul.
I'm what is for, referred to as a unicorn in this city. Yeah, it's a very rare thing. Yes.
Yeah. So Portland's changed a lot in your life, I guess.
It has.
To your chagrin?
No, not at all.
No? Okay.
Oh, I'm cool with this. I think it's fun. You know? It's just interesting. And Portland's a really easy place to live. I mean, really, now it's getting much more expensive, but it's a really easy place to live.
Interesting. So, yeah. And Toronto's super expensive now. It's crazy. Yeah, it's crazy how expensive it is to live in the city of Toronto. All right, so let's switch gears. What about business? Back to lighting. What do we got here, Greg, on this Get a Grip on Lighting podcast?
Yeah, I think a nice summary is good.
Nice summer.
You know, we're at 40 minutes, but...
Are we at 40 minutes? Yeah. Are you hungry? Are you
getting No. I think summing up, some of the key points is what I like from the inventory side. I don't know if I have any other real question.
Okay. So maybe we'll get off on another tangent. You never know. So what is it, at 40? Yeah, 41 minutes. So, okay. And I'm getting a little bit peckish. You know, I'll tell you, Portland, man, they have great food in the city. It is phenomenal. It is not a rumor, folks. Portland has really good food. We went
bunch
to about
three and four
six
star.
Restaurants yesterday, I think.
And all you had to do was walk around a block.
That's it. And the next one was better than the one before. So back to inventory.
Yeah,
turns, there's a calculation there. What is it? You want to sum up this stuff, right?
Yeah. So we're talking how many times your product line turns in a year.
Sells in a year.
Yeah.
And a good number, six is great.
Six is ideal, I think, because that's when you start to go over that.
And that's of stock. You take your drop shipping out. You take your drop shipping out of that, right.
But see, when people try to go too hard on that, that's when they start jeopardizing their customer service side.
Metric for customer service called again?
Customer service percentage is the metric. And it's basically the number of times that you can ship complete versus the number of times ordered. So,
have you written any books, Jason?
I have not. No, that is not true. I wrote one book with my former partner,
and
burned it. So
why? Oh, really?
Yeah, I had to burn it. Yeah,
I think you should read it. I think you should write a book about inventory management.
I think I have it. I think I still have the damn thing up there. I don't know. It's terrible. Yeah, I did actually. We wrote one together. And okay. then...
what was her name? I saw her on the internet.
Oh, no, no. Dana was a different one. Yeah, okay. no, this was Scott. He was a previous... Okay. He was the guy I bought the business from.
Oh, okay. You know, yeah.
So got me into this consulting side and whatnot. No, we wrote a book together. Can't even remember what it was called anymore because... literally the day that it got published. I mean, I'm sitting there, drive up to the publisher, which is about an hour and a half away. I've got, 50 cases of this silly book. And then my partner, former partner decides to break his non-compete and do some, it was some bad stuff.
Oh, no.
And so I said, I can't publish a book with his picture on it or my, with my name. I said, I'm done. So I don't really want to write a book. I thought about it, and I like this better. This is much more interesting.
Much more interesting, much easier.
Keystone
Technologies. Visit KeystoneTech.com. That's KeystoneETech.com. They are sponsoring this episode. Don't forget their line voltage T5 and T5HO and T5HE LED tube replacements, which are rocking for a ton of reasons. Also, Weston Mission Hills Rancho Mirage, California, in February 13th to 16th. Be there or be square for Nailed Innovation. That's always a good time. Come down there, learn a little bit about light bulbs, learn to get some relationships going, figure out what's going on in the lighting game. And thank you, Jason Bader, for coming on the show. Jason, we really appreciate it. You helped us get this thing started, and we hope you've gotten some business from it as well. So distributionteam.com. Jason can help you out if you need some help managing your inventory or really just looking at your business as a whole. That's distributionteam.com. Thanks again. Bye for now.